my love, this have I done for my true love. For my true love.
Tomorrow shall be my dancing day. Music from Bob Bennett. 12 minutes now after the hour. It's a Monday, and that means we're graced with the presence of Dr. Don Clark, who is a biochemist, member of the Board of Creation Moments, and he comes to us from Garden Valley, Texas. Don, good morning. Happy day to you.
Well, good morning, Jim, and good morning, Dave. Morning. Yes, it's a brisk day here, but I'm sure it's not as cold here as it is there.
Well, we got 2 degrees. We're on the plus side this morning.
Oh, boy.
It's going to be up in the 20s today.
Yeah, we got, four days
yeah.
of tropical weather here, and then we'll be back in the deep freeze. But we're used to that, and, of course, that's why we're here. That's why we're not there with you, Don, because we make odd choices is why. David.
Yeah, well, it's I think it's about 40 degrees here at the moment. Okay. Had a little frost on the ground again this morning, but I think it's supposed to get up into the low 50s, maybe.
Or were you out hugging your grapevines to keep them warm, or do you worry about that?
No, they're all dormant now.
Okay. Kind of withered and brown-looking things out there?
Well, yeah, most of the leaves are off. Okay. There's some that still have some leaves on, but they're all brown.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go and start our first pruning today, just a little lighter today. So,
you know, and just so folks know, Dr. Don also is a, what's the vigneur? What's the French?
Vigneron.
Yeah, he's grown grapes and making wine. His first batch is cooking away there someplace, aging. And I was thinking about you this morning because I'm thinking of Doug Greenwald, and he talks, you know, from Preserving Bible Times. I don't know if you've caught him on the air or listened to his podcast, but he's talked frequently about first century Middle Eastern vineyards. And how different they are from the cultivation of grapevines here. And I'm thinking, you know, like Gisele on Thursday gets us connected with different people and different. I wonder if Doug could find us an Israeli vigneron, and we could kind of compare, because you know, historically they made just sweet red wines. I think now my knowledge there is pretty thin. I know they made sweet red wines, and it comes to us now in the form of like Mogan David wines and those Jewish wines you can buy. But I'm wondering if they ever made really what we would consider good wines, nice dry wines. Do you know, Don?
I don't know. That's a very good question. I do know that at least you know, historically, way back. And certainly would cover biblical times that they were using. Obviously, they didn't have cultivated yeast, so they were using wild yeast. And wild yeast does not get you as high of alcohol content as the cultivated yeast that we have today. It's very possible that all the wine, whatever wine that they made, was on the sweeter side.
Mm-hmm. Well,
some of the bitter vineyards in Israel make Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Syrah, Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon Chardonnay, and Gewürztraminer.
Really? Well, there's a sweet wine.
That's a very southern area for Gewürztraminer.
So, of course, now they would have access to modern yeast, though. I mean, they wouldn't have to go out and tame their yeast. They wouldn't have to go out and round up a bunch of yeast from the hillside and bring it into the winery.
Yeah, no, the yeast come from all over the world now, actually.
So apparently they have a good grape-growing climate and soil there.
Where did you get the idea that Israeli wine is all tastes like Mogan David?
Well, I didn't say it all tastes like Mogan David. I said that's what we see now, what we think of. But we did pose this question to Doug at one point when he's talking about Israeli vineyards. Hmm. And we were wondering, you know, if Jesus turned the water to wine, what kind of wine was it? Because they liked it.
That would be nice to know.
it was obviously red, because it's symbolic of, you know, it was in the casks where the guests at the wedding, this was the wedding at Cana now, is his first public miracle, changed the water to wine. It was in the clay jars, the large jars, I think it's like 30, 40-gallon jars, where they would wash their hands before going in to the wedding ceremony. It was a ceremonial cleansing. But now there was red wine, so it's symbolic of blood. And the idea being that he was really starting to teach his new disciples. Remember, his disciples only been with him for about a week at that time. And he was breaking them into this obvious truth that salvation is going to be by blood. It was symbolic. But the people at the party inside saw wine, and they liked it a lot. They said, mm-hmm. You saved the best for last.
Would the area around Canaan be in which region?
You know, that's along the that's kind of like northwest Israel, and then down into the coast.
Northern Galilee?
Yep.
Upper Galilee?
Northern Galilee, western
area. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Upper Galilee is one of the designated wine-growing areas of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, usually what that means, when a European country designates a particular area, there are specific grapes that grow extremely well in that area. Now, the Mogan David flavor characteristic is very much like grapes that grow in this country, and the ones that grow wild.
Uh-huh.
You know, with the beard cloying
like
sweet.
Scuppernong.
Yeah. The jug wines.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a very unchallenging, but, you know, the Mogan David Company has done really well because that's the wine that's served in churches and synagogues for communion and celebrations and mm-hmm. things like that, mostly because it's really cheap. you know, because you're serving 600, so you know you don't want to spend $58 a bottle.
I'd like to know if Doug, you know, goes over there several times a year. I wonder if he would know someone who is in the wine business in Israel. We could get it directly from the vineyard's mouth, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
we could do that. Right. That'd be interesting.
There are four regions, designated regions in the area of the Galilee: Upper, Lower, Golden Heights, and Tabor. And then there's the Shamram region, the Shimshon region, and a number of other regions. So, you know, grape growing is an agricultural activity, of course. So, you know, it's going to be grown a lot in the north, not so much in the south.
Well, yeah, the south would be a whole different kind of environment.
But you know, it could be depending upon the drainage and the prevailing winds. And they've got ocean currents
mm-hmm.
that would help a great deal. So,
okay.
Wind
currents. Well, but you don't see, at least I have not seen, Israeli wines for sale here. Anybody else, Don, have you?
No, I haven't.
They may not export it.
The biggest function of wines, foreign wines sold in this country, is can you get enough to put in a container cartridge or container shipment that will drive the price down?
Ah, so, okay.
So cheapskate Americans will be able to afford
mm-hmm.
it. And, you know, China is one of the world's premier winemaking regions.
Oh, I didn't know
that. And they make outstanding wine. They make some real awful stuff, too.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't make enough of it that it will pay more than selling it to their people themselves.
Okay, gotcha.
I mean, if they had, you know, Australia makes ocean tankers full of wine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and the big thing about exporting wine is you got to have enough, because every liquor store is going to have three cases, and you got hundreds of thousands of liquor stores. So it doesn't make any sense to bring it over.
I wonder if you could buy it online. Might be expensive, the shipping stuff. Anyway, we'll have to find. We'll research that. But, yeah, Don, just for your benefit, we'll see if we can contact an Israeli winemaker.
You know, that'd be fun.
We'll trade
that'd be
thoughts.
A lot of fun.
Yeah, especially I'm especially interested in Bible times, you know, what it was like then, and hopefully
yeah, absolutely.
Know the history. There's another topic, though, at hand. And Dr. Don typically comes on the air, and we talk about creation and evolution and science and faith and matters like that. There was a story published just the other day. Now, this is a UPI story, but it's about the Mars rover, Curiosity. That's the name of the rover that's up there wandering around the planet of Mars. And it seems that the rover has made its first age determination of rock off the Earth. It's doing its own experiments up there. It's drilling, it's finding rock samples, and it's testing it somehow for age. Don, can you tell us how that test might be accomplished on the face of Mars?
Well, the article, obviously, since it's a UPI article, was a little sparse, but they did say that they were doing the standard test for any, you know, age calculations, mm-hmm. and that's with a mass spectrometer. And what a mass spectrometer does is it whatever elements that you have, let's say in the rock in this case, it would break those elements down, and it actually kind of ionizes the elements, passes it through a magnetic field, which then separates the elements, or the ions, in terms of mass, and then has a detector at the other end. And as the ions are passing through and being detected, you'll get a readout as to, direct readout as to which ions are coming off and what their mass is.
Well, you get a readout of what elements are in the rock then, right?
So you're analyzing the elements. So you're breaking down the rock and you're analyzing the elements that are in the rock. And specifically, you're looking for radioisotope elements. And you're looking for, let's say, I'm just taking uranium as an example. I don't know if they actually were using uranium, but let's say they were taking uranium. And then they were looking for the daughter elements of uranium as uranium breaks down into several different types of other
elements. That's what they would refer to as an isotope, right? It's a type of the parent element.
Well, an isotope, you can have uranium has several different isotopes of itself, and then the breakdown products could be an isotope. In other words, they could be radioactive or they could be non-radioactive. Ultimately, uranium breaks down into lead, but polonium, for example, is one of the elements that it breaks down to relatively quickly. And so you look for those, and then you kind of say, well, how much parent element do I have, and how much daughter element do I have? Or child element do I have? And we take the ratio of that, and lo and behold, we can determine what the age of the rock is.
So first, the mass spectrometer tells you what's there, what elements are involved in this specimen that you have, and then you can make that comparison between the parent and daughter elements to see how much of it is degraded into the daughter product and measure the age.
Yes, that's correct. And so It not only tells you what's there, but how much is there, and so you can do that calculation. It's a relatively simple calculation, but there are assumptions that go into the calculation.
Well, the one statement that kind of caught my eye here, this is from Caltech geochemist Ken Farley. They determined the age of the samples that Curiosity had gathered to be between 3.86 billion and 4.56 billion years old. And they quoted Farley as saying, in one sense, this is an utterly unsurprising result. It's the number that everybody expected. I guess you can't help but expect to find something, but does that then color your findings too? Don't you, try to match your expectations? Do you skew the data?
Well, I don't know if the data, I'd have to look at the original article to see whether or not they're selectively picking out the numbers that they want. But chances are, they're not. But it's the technique that they're using, which is the same technique that they use here. And more importantly, it's the assumptions that they are making. And one of the biggest assumptions is that, gee, when all of this started, there were no daughter ions, for example. There were no daughter elements from the parent. We generated the parent somehow, and there were no daughter.
You're talking when all this started. Example. You're talking about at the moment of creation.
At the moment, yeah. Mm-hmm. Whenever it was created. Mm-hmm. So that way you can say, well, I add up all of the daughter or the child elements, if you will, and add that to the parent. How much parent is there, and that's how much. Parent was there at the beginning, and looking at the ratios, then you can say, well, gee, this is the age of this particular rock or sample that we're taking. So if they're using the same technique both here on Earth and in space on Mars, now we did have some you know, meteorites and stuff that could be analyzed, and the same type of experiments were done. So they generally had a feeling as to, well, okay, what's the age of you know, space dust, if you will, or space stuff, and it falls into I guess that bracket of age. And so when they analyzed the Mars results came in, they said, aha, you see, it's about the same as what we expected. So that's mm-hmm. how they got to that particular experiment and those particular comments. Now, what we have to ask ourselves is that date actually correct? Well, like I said, the first assumption was everything started with the parent, and there were no daughter elements. Is that assumption correct? Did God create everything that way, or were there some daughter to start off with?
That's a good point. That had never occurred to me. That you just fall into that assumption, don't you?
You do, and it's a natural it's a natural assumption. But is it correct? I and there's no way of knowing mm-hmm. really, other than saying, well, you know, we believe this is how the universe evolved, and if it evolved this way, then we would expect at the very beginning that there was no daughter elements.
Well, it's an expedient too, because if you try to start without that assumption, there's no place you can go.
Right, exactly.
You're left without a way to measure anything and accumulate meaningful data. So that assumption is almost essential to the process. Well, it is essential to the process.
Well, it is. It's kind of hard to say, well, okay, this is maybe not 3 billion or 4 billion years old. Maybe it's only 100 million years old. Mm-hmm. If you don't know what the starting point is, you can't answer that particular mm-hmm. question. The other major assumption is that degradation rates, the radioactive decay rate for that particular element that they're looking at, let's say uranium again as an example, is constant, has been constant over time. Now, that is a larger assumption, and there has been a study, or actually a 8-year study done by the folks initiated, at least by the Institute of Creation Research, several years ago, called the RATE, R-A-T-E study, and they showed in the experiments that they've done, that they did, and that, well, you know, gee, it looks like in the past, at least in the Earth's history past, that the radioactive decay rate, and they were looking at uranium, looks like it accelerated twice in Earth's history. And they determined that from polonium halos, for example, in zeolite crystals was one, and I can explain that. It's polonium is a, like I said before, is a daughter of uranium, and the half-life of polonium is very, very quick. It's like I think the longest one is like 3 days, mm-hmm. and so it doesn't hang around. Well, if it's in a crystal, and you get what the halos are is polonium, for example, shoots off alpha particles, which is basically helium without the electrons, and depending on the energy of the particles that are emitted from your isotope, will determine how far out in the crystal the halo or the discoloration will be in your crystal. Well, if this whole process was slow, there would be no polonium halo mm-hmm. residual in the crystal at all, because it would have dissipated. It wouldn't have built up enough uranium in any particular one spot to allow for that to happen by the time the rock actually cooled. But we see we have evidence of a lot of these halos, And so it suggests that, well, gee, at some point in time, uranium had to decay very, very quickly in order to deposit enough polonium, you know, somewhere else in the rock to form these halos. So that's one example. The other example, the other thing that they found, which was a complete surprise, was that, like I said, one of the decay products of these radioactive materials is an alpha particle, which then forms helium. So they looked for helium in these crystals, and you know, everybody thought, well, you know, if these rocks are really, really old, there would be absolutely no helium left because it diffuses through the rock, you know, in these crystals. And lo and behold, they found helium. And they did some experiments of helium diffusion rates through these rocks, and their experiments and their fusion rates said, well, you know, it looks like these rocks can't be more than 10,000 years old. So it's if, you know, the listeners actually really want to dive into this, I would suggest that they would go to the Institute of Creation Research's site, icr.org, and search under RATE, R-A-T-E, and there's a number of papers that they have on their site on this particular subject.
What conditions would exist on the Earth that might speed the decay rate of uranium? Do we know? Any idea?
Well, it looks like at least the second time, they believe was during the during creation, you know, during the creation week itself, sometime, mm-hmm. somewhere during creation week, mm-hmm. The decay rates were much, much faster than they are today. The other appears to be, you know, speculating at the time of the flood, because they took samples from canyons, for example, that were a direct result of the flood. And some of the samples that they took were, you know, post after wash through at one time and then another time. And they you know, came up with different, even though it was kind of like the same sample, it came up with two different, majorly different rates. So, I mean, majorly different ages as tested by the traditional means.
Well, those would have been the two time periods then, and I have some thoughts about the one on creation. If God were creating essentially what we see now, then that parent-daughter relationship would have been part of the process. In other words, creation wasn't done until those daughter products existed.
Right, and if it isn't another part of the study, they actually it's worth going and reading those articles, and they also have a book and a video that explains it to, quite well, actually. If you they actually did some calculations on the strong nuclear forces, and it seems that it doesn't take much perturbation of the strong nuclear forces within the nucleus of a isotope, for example, to cause major changes in the decay rate. So something, and they don't know, and we don't know, nobody knows what could have possibly perturbed the strong nuclear forces.
But, would it be radiation of some kind, electromagnetic, or? Or some other.
Well, like they said, they're not speculating as to what it possibly could have been. I mean, I speculated and discussed it with some of these guys that were on the study, and they said, "Well, we just don't know." Mm-hmm. They wouldn't commit to anything.
Well, that's so just admitting that you don't know is kind of refreshing. You know?
Yeah,
it gives you confidence in what they do tell you.
So they don't know the reason why what time frame and creation week, you know, that all happened. Was it very, very quickly after, you know, God said, let there be light, and he put a spin on light, and he separated the light from the darkness? Was it, you know, at that period of time? Was it after the earth was formed? You know, who knows? God does, obviously, but we don't. don't know.
Well, we're working on it. But we're working on it.
Was it about the flood, for example, that caused a perturbation, which then caused the decay to accelerate? You know, and they don't know the answer to that either. Mm-hmm. All they know is it looks like, you know, two times in our history that there were accelerations in the decay rate. If that is indeed the case, and it certainly looks like that, then you've got a problem for any dating method like this that relies on radioisotopic dating. Because the rate, as I said before, one of the assumptions in determining these dates is that the rate is constant. And if the rate isn't constant throughout history, then it kind of throws your numbers off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are some other evidence outside of that particular 8-year research study that suggests that, hey, now wait a minute, maybe this dating technique isn't quite what it's, you know, cracked up to be, because if you look at rocks that you know the age of, for example, volcanic rocks, you know when the volcano erupted and you know when that rock came, you know, to the surface and solidified. You date that, you get spurious dates for that rock. It doesn't match up at all. For example, you could say, well, I know that this rock is a year old because that's when the volcano erupted and deposited this rock. But yet when you go to date it, you'll find it's millions and millions of years old. Well, you know, that date can't be true. So you got to kind of scratch your head and say, what happened there? It's not quite working out the way we thought it was going to work out. You get different results. Example is that you get different results based on the different dating methods that you use, and depending on the different radioisotopes that you use as the parent and the daughter, for example, you get different dates for the same rock. And you know, if the dating was accurate, you shouldn't have that disparity, you know, mm-hmm. in your dating methods. They should all come up, you know, it's not going to be 100% exact, but they should be pretty close. But you get very different ages for the same rock with different isotope dating methods, starting with, like I said, different parent isotopes and looking at different daughter isotopes. And then if you look at, and the other one is if you look at different dating methods based on anything else, I mean, something else other than radioisotopes, for example, the helium that I mentioned earlier, or erosion that we can definitely see, you know, let's say at the, you know, at some point, you know, on Earth, if you look at erosion rates and then calculate, well, you know, how old that should be, that gives you a much different date than the radioisotope dating. Magnetic field decay is another one, and so forth. Original tissue, you know, fossils that we've talked about, for example, many times on this program with the soft tissue studies. All of those are suggesting that the Earth is young and not old like these radioisotope techniques, you know, suggest.
Well, and the article over at upi.com, and again, this is just a brief summary of the actual findings from NASA. I imagine you can look up the actual original documents if you choose. But they said that the sample analyzed was sedimentary rock. It formed in layers over a span of millions of years. There's another assumption, from material eroded from the crater walls. And thus, the sample drilled by Curiosity really represents the combined age of those bits and pieces. So maybe they're afraid to be too specific or to tout these findings too precisely. And they go on to say the rover's instruments were not designed for this purpose, and we weren't sure if the experiment was going to work. But the fact that our number is consistent with previous estimates suggests that the technique works. There's another assumption.
Right. Yep. Yeah. There's a lot of assumptions in these in these types of calculations. And all we can say is that they're consistently getting the same consistently wrong answer.
well, consistency is a good thing, I suppose.
Using the same techniques, I mean, it's and the same methods and the same assumptions.
Well, is mainstream science paying attention at all to the work done by the Institute of Creation Research? I mean, did that gain some traction someplace?
Oh, it did. At the time when the studies came out, there was a lot of consternation over the results. And volumes of people, you know, criticizing and writing, well, how this stuff can't be right, and this and that and the other.
But did they criticize the science, or did they just cast aspersions on the Institute?
They criticized the science. They criticized the scientists who were top in their field. Mm-hmm. They criticized, you know, the laboratories that did the work, which are the same laboratories that do the work for everybody else. They criticized everything, you know, about it. They criticized the helium diffusion rates. They criticized having helium in the rocks and all of this, you know, anything you can think of, they criticized. But to actually sit down and have a nice discussion about the results, you know, that didn't happen. You know, because the deep time is so embedded in the atheistic evolutionary concept that you cannot accept that, oh, you mean the Earth could be less than 10,000 years old? You know, that just doesn't compute, because obviously if the Earth is less than 10,000 years old, then we didn't get here by evolving. And, you know, molecules didn't go to man. And my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandpa is not a rock, as I thought he was. And, you know, and those type of things go away, and that hits at the heart of man's, you know, existence, if you will. This whole question of origins is quite inflammatory. And when you suggest that there is a creator and the results, you know, point you in that direction, people get very upset.
Well, when you throw away those original assumptions, science is left with nothing to do but pray.
Yeah. Well, there's plenty to do, believe me. In science, I mean, the whole world of biology is just so fascinating. And there's like the cell is made up of these molecular machines that we could spend, you know, lifetimes studying just the biology itself, and, you know, walk away and say, wow, you know, that is amazing. If we could ever, you know, duplicate something like that, we could do this or we could do that. But instead, you know, we kind of look the other way and say, well, you know, everything is the whole universe, according to our calculations, which are, you know, bogus, or is, you know, 13.7 to 13.8 billion years old. And that, you know, keeps changing because of the techniques that we use to calculate that number. You know, the longer the time, the better for evolution. So we want to stretch that out as much as possible. So it's it becomes a you know, kind of gut reaction that when you say, hey, you know, the whole this Earth of ours is at least the Earth, and according to the Bible, everything else, because the Earth was formed first, you know, is less than 10,000 years old. And, you know, of course, I believe it's 6,000 plus years, you know, or in that time frame. You know, that really gets people looking at you strangely.
Well, you know, in science and in philosophy, contradictions cannot exist. They have to be explained away, reasoned away. Because in real life, there are no contradictions. If it's an apparent contradiction, the old saw in philosophy is, if you encounter a contradiction, go back and re-examine your premise. And the same should hold in science.
Or just make fun of the person who made a contradiction.
There you go. Yeah.
Point fingers at him and say, you knucklehead. How can anybody with a reasonable mind think such an outrageous notion?
Yeah.
Don, I just finished reading a book called The Ruling Class, and it's more an expanded essay than it is a book or a novel. It's only probably 100 pages at the most, but it talks about the growing concentration around Washington, D.C. of certain people who think the same, act the same, and have the same kinds of desires. But one of their common things is they look around and they see the great unwashed out there in the rest of the country and say, you know, we know better how to run your life than you do. And we're much brighter, smarter, and better looking. So we should be in charge, and we're going to do this whether you like it or not.
And it's for your own good.
Yes, it's for your own good.
Because we love you.
Sit down and eat your peas. Just take it. And, oh, by the way, pay this tax. And
well, yeah, and there's...
And it has nothing to do with merits or study or true science or true discovery or hard work or intelligence. It's the folks that have gotten control of the status quo. And you know, you're talking about ruining the Rice Bowl. You're talking about upsetting their grants. Mm-hmm. You're talking about, you know, turning over their apple cart. And, you know, you know, when logic and reason runs out, which it usually does pretty quickly, all they're left with is you, knucklehead. And that's it.
Ridicule, right. The first line of defense of scoundrels, I think.
Ah, yeah, yes.
I think so.
Yeah, that gets repeated over and over and over again, doesn't it? Mm. I mean, both in politics and science and mm-hmm. you know, just about every walk of life.
It's a trait of fallen human beings, I think. It's just you got to deal with it. We're talking with Dr. Don Clark. Don, a member of the board, the board of directors at Creation Moments. Creation Moments has a wonderful website themselves. We've been talking about the Institute of Creation Research, but this is a separate organization. It's creationmoments.com. You can link to them from our website. Don lives and works and grows grapes in Garden Valley, Texas. And Don, we're just so pleased you find time for us every Monday morning. It's just great to have you along. And we thank you. Thank you.
Speaking
for
of wine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
there's a winery, and the Israeli wine industry has gone through all kinds of permutations, just like every other country and every other wine growing area. But the all the vines, all the ancient vines were pulled out and destroyed when the Islamic nations ran over the country.
Something else they killed.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And they decimated the... You know, the very lush wineries. There's mm-hmm. there's all kinds of evidence of old ancient wineries and vats and presses and
wine
all the
rest.
Yeah,
cut into stone, sure.
And the resurgence of the Israeli wine industry now is in the last 20 years. So it's really
recent.
Really
it is
recent.
Brand new, yeah.
Very, oh, wow. Very recent.
Oh. Yeah, so I'm not that far behind then.
Yeah, you know, you're right behind.
You can catch up.
You're on their heels.
Yeah,
there is the oldest one in the country is or one of the oldest ones is a place called Margalit, and they make a Cabernet and an Enigma. What they're selling on their website is the 07. It's, I mean, it's 7 years older.
So you can buy it on the website.
Yeah.
They could ship you a bottle at a
wow,
precious price.
Expensive.
Yeah.
Well, they'd probably want to ship you a case. I doubt if they'd ship a bottle.
Well, we could go together on that, I suppose.
Do you have the card ready? Let me give you the number here, and I'll just put the card
well,
in.
That's okay. We'll consider this.
$720 a bottle or a case.
$720 a case.
Yeah, it's a blend called Enigma. It doesn't sound too bad.
It sounds like they don't know what it is either.
Well, it's 42% Cabernet Sauvignon,
okay. All right.
Cabernet Franc, and then a little bit of Merlot. Okay. And what I don't know is that how much of the wines are grown in. Well, I would think if they've got an appellation, they've got to grow it there. But the industry was started in the 19th century by Baron Rothschild.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
Oh, really?
Sent over some of his grapes. Yep.
Well, he probably had an historical interest in wine growing there too, because. The Bible makes a lot of references to wine and grapes and vintners. It's an important part of Jesus' teaching. It's common in the parables and stories that he told. So interesting stuff. Don, again, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate having you here. And stay warm.
40s, yep,
you have no problem staying warm. You don't even need earmuffs at 40s.
Oh, yeah, no earmuffs. I mean, it's warm enough that we can just go out and enjoy the day. It's going to be a bright, sunny day today.
Well, good. Cool. We'll see you next week, okay?
Okay, we'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay, see you, Don.